Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. At 9 p.m. East Coast time, President Trump announced his choice of Judge Brett Kavanaugh for the U.S. Supreme Court. Protesters had already lined up at the Supreme Court building, and during the evening, they were joined by some Senate Democrats who pledged to do all they could to prevent Judge Kavanaugh from being confirmed. That helped to dramatize the stage for what promises to be a bitter battle and almost certainly a losing battle. So, is it worth the political bloodshed? Theda Scotchpole is director of the Scholars Strategy Network at Harvard University, and we're delighted to have you on our program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Here are some statements by people that will be familiar, I think, to our listeners. Charles Schumer, I will oppose Judge Kavanaugh's nomination with everything I have. I hope a bipartisan majority will do the same. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Trump wants to put Brett Kavanaugh on the SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States, but he can't do it without a Senate majority. It's time to fight. Bernie Sanders, nothing is more important now than doing everything in our power to stop the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. What do you see happening next?
If you're asking me, I think there'll be an argument. I think it'll be a vigorous argument over the next couple of months, and then I think Judge Kavanaugh will be confirmed as Justice Kavanaugh.
Is the argument going to be worth it?
Yeah, you know, in politics, arguments are always worth it, especially if you can bring out the range of issues that matter. This is a very consequential appointment. It happens that the Democrats lost this battle in 2014 and 2016, and this is the least surprising nomination in my lifetime to the Supreme Court. He's a very conservative Republican in a time when Republicans can't get conservative enough. But I think Democrats need to put up a good argument, clarify the stakes for everyone in the country, so that eventually people will be able to understand what's happening with this new court. But I don't think they should try to drag this out right up to the midterms, because they're going to lose it.
What about creating false expectations on the part of people who think, given the rhetoric they hear, that maybe there really is a chance for the Democrats to stop this nomination?
I don't think anybody thinks that. The evidence I see suggests that a lot of Democrats understand that this is a long shot fight. I doubt you're going to see a great deal of people thinking that this one can be won by Chuck Schumer. You saw Chuck Schumer say he's going to give it everything he has. Well, everything he has is not going to be enough.
So would it be wiser from a political standpoint to say we're going to lose this, but we just want to make these arguments? Or is it necessary to say we're going to fight and try to stop it?
Well, it's necessary to have the arguments. And you can see that they're suggesting that it takes a bipartisan majority to stop it, and they'll put forth an argument. And it's possible that there'll be enough public protest that it could make a difference.
Public protest might make a difference.
If there's an interpretation that I think would be accurate, that Kavanaugh will gut the federal government's ability to regulate health insurance companies, for example, I think that argument may very well move quite a few people in the country. But, you know, winning and losing isn't the whole thing. It's also how you lose. And you can't lose by just giving up in advance before an argument.
Theda Scotchpole, once again, at Harvard University. Also with us today, the author of an op-ed piece that appeared one day after the president's announcement called, or titled, I should say, in the New York Times, A Liberal's Case for Brett Kavanaugh. The author is Akhil Reed Amar. He is a professor at the Yale Law School, and he's a one-time teacher of Judge Kavanaugh. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Is it because you were his teacher that you're a liberal who supports this man to be on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it's because I do know him and his body of work, as I've come to know the body of work of several of the other people on President Trump's announced list. So I agree with Professor Scotchpole that some fights are worth fighting, that the Democrats will probably lose. But there's a difference between losing and actually creating a backlash to actually be worse off because you lost. So I think there are two real dangers, at least. One, suppose you win. fine, you're going to get someone worse than Judge Kavanaugh by your own lights, way worse the next time around, I believe. Because I think Judge Kavanaugh is far and away the best person on the list. The best we could do if, you know, we being Democrats, I'm a Democrat, given that we lost in 2014 in the Senate, 2016 for the presidency, 2016 for the Senate. So the dog chases the car. Improbably the dog catches the car. Fine. Now what's the dog going to do with the car? Okay, so suppose you actually succeeded in making this very personal and very nasty and defeating him. I think you're going to get someone by your own lights worse off. That's, you know, one problem. Second is you don't succeed and you actually alienate folks in the middle because you haven't been fair to the fellow. He's on the Supreme Court anyway, and he's less perhaps disposed to, he's going to try to keep an open mind, but he's only human, as we all are. Is that actually the best strategy? The nomination confirmation game, I'm a student of the Constitution, a political scientist and a law professor, is structured to give the president and the nominee certain first mover advantages. You have to vote no on a human being with a family and a face and friends, and he's actually I think he'll be very compelling when he tries to make a case for himself. And when you vote no, it's not like amending a bill, and you can't bottle it up. Senator McConnell is going to insist that he get a fair vote and he get a chance to show himself for the American people. And when you vote no, you can't control who the next nominee is. Again, the president has this first mover advantage, and he may give you someone even less good by your light. So the system is designed, and always has been, to give the president and the nominee certain advantages. Oh, and the Senate is a hydra. It's not one person, it's 100. And Chuck Schumer might prefer X over Garland, Kavanaugh. He might prefer Garland, or another senator might prefer Y, but there may be no one that the Senate as a whole prefers. One thing that I said in my op-ed is, if you're going to vote against Kavanaugh, name the people that are clearly better that a Republican president would reasonably nominate.
Let's go in a moment to those proposals that you made. I think they're very interesting. And I just want to point out, in reference to what you said about the family, that he certainly presented a beautiful family and, had a fist bump with his younger daughter during the presentation. They were beautiful people. And so from that standpoint, he certainly presented himself as well as he could.
Indeed. That's the nature of a process that's about actually a human being. They were spoiling for a fight. I'm a Democrat, but they were spoiling for a fight before even the name was announced. And we've lost sight of the fact that actually it is about a human being who I believe, as I said, is a very good scholar, a very fair and decent and honorable person. I was strongly supportive of Judge Garland, and you know what? You know who else was at the time? Brett Kavanaugh was. He said nice things about Judge Garland, and you should not be surprised if Merrick Garland says nice things about Brett Kavanaugh. But certain politicians on each side want to generate money, go to their base, mobilize people. I understand all of that, but I think there are costs to our system, and there could even be costs for my party, the Democratic Party. I think actually not only could we lose, we could actually hurt ourselves.
Merrick Garland, of course, the judge that was appointed by Barack Obama to serve on the Supreme Court, his appointment denied, never even held a hearing by the Republicans in the Senate. Right. Professor Scotchpole,
on just one second.
Sure.
It's not appointed, nominated.
Okay, nominated. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's a very important distinction to be made, obviously, because it's the Senate that does the confirming.
Yes.
So let me go back to Professor Scotchpole. What about this term backlash? I asked you a bit about that earlier, but do you think that is a real danger for the Democrats?
With this nomination, I don't. And, you know, let's be careful here. This is not a personality contest. And I doubt that you're going to hear any prominent Democrats saying personally nasty things about Judge Kavanaugh. He's obviously qualified in the sense that he's an able jurist. And after all, he's a graduate of Yale? So we know he's superb. There are public issues of great importance here, and there is absolutely nothing wrong, as the professor has implied, with bringing out the full range of those issues in a hearing process. The Constitution assigns the Senate the job of doing that. And as for the idea that this is the best person a Republican president could have nominated, you know, I just think that's poppycock. President Trump could have chosen a more middle-of-the-road jurist, conservative-leaning but moderate, just as Barack Obama did, a moderate liberal with Merrick Garland, who was treated in a very shabby way and is a very nice person, too. President Trump chose to outsource the selection of his judges, this and many other judges, to the Federalist Society. And the Federalist Society has a clear ideological plan for disabling American government in a whole series of ways that the majority of Americans don't want to see done. It's perfectly appropriate in a respectful and vigorous way for Democrats to bring out that range of issues in hearings and in public discussions. And I don't think you're going to see people taking swipes at Judge Kavanaugh personally or at his family in any inappropriate way.
Akhil Reed Amar, poppycock?
Well, I hope that that's so. I don't think it was actually very respectful last night. I wish it had been more. Sam Alito's wife at his confirmation hearings was brought to tears. We remember, of course, the very personal confirmation process of Judge Clarence Thomas. I think people on the other side of the aisle, I think, kind of went after my dear friend Sonia Sotomayor in various ways, trying to. But I agree absolutely with Professor Scotchpole that there's nothing wrong whatsoever in having a very vigorous hearing going into Judge Kavanaugh's views. Indeed, if you took a look at the op-ed, you'll see that I'm calling for a far more open conversation about constitutional issues in the confirmation process, frankly, than we've seen in the last two decades, which I think have descended into more personal attacks because some people think, oh, I can't just openly say, you got the credentials, but I have a different constitutional vision. I think yours is erroneous, and that's why I'm voting against you with respect. I prefer that we just bring the policy and constitutional vision issues into open debate. I think that's a similarity with what Professor Scotchpole has said. We bring that out rather than trying to demean someone's credentials or attack their personas. So, and that would be good for the Republic.
All right. We'll be right back. So I suspect that you both would prefer that personalities not be involved, they might or might not, as the process goes on. But Professor Scotchpole, you began by saying that the judge is liable to rule in such a way that health insurance regulation is more difficult for the government. Elaborate on that, if you will, and other issues that you're concerned about based on his record.
Well, you know, I haven't studied all his cases, but I have studied some of them, and I do, and I am aware of the fact that he has consistently voted to weaken federal regulations. He's also shown in public statements open hostility to the Affordable Care Act. So I think the fact that yet another suit is pending that may or may not get to the Supreme Court, I'm not sure it will, because I'm not sure that the Chief Justice will want to have another round of this. One that focuses on the pre-existing condition regulation of insurance companies and is an absolutely core part of the most popular, widely popular parts of government regulation of health insurance. That case could come before the court, and I wouldn't trust Judge Kavanaugh to uphold it. That's a perfectly valid, that's not a personal attack. If he is found to have lied in some way in the past when his full record is expanded, it's perfectly appropriate to discuss that. But I don't expect that to be the case. I think Judge Kavanaugh is a skilled political operator, and I think he will do exactly what he needs to do to present himself effectively in hearings which by now are almost meaningless in the confirmation process. So the larger discussion will have to take place in public, and I think it will. It should, because this is not an appointment in isolation. It may be followed by yet another one within a year if Justice Thomas decides to step down. And it's very important for Americans to be aware of the large stakes for how the Supreme Court might rule in a whole series of areas that are vital to the lives of individuals and families in this country.
Professor Amar, I don't think that Judge Kavanaugh has been accused of lying, but he certainly has changed his position with regard to one of the issues that the court might well be faced with during the Trump presidency, and that is the powers of the office of the president. Tell us a bit about that and how his opinions have evolved since he served kind of the Starr and the when Starr was the special prosecutor looking into the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Will do. I agree with Professor Scotchpole that the current confirmation process is actually broken. I say in the op-ed, it basically has alternated between being a rubber stamp and a witch hunt. I actually, the part of the op-ed that I'm equally proud of, along with my endorsement of Judge Kavanaugh, are suggestions for a reformed process in which candidates answer all fair questions about their legal views, which is not what we've had before. So that's if that were to happen, it would be, I think, the biggest thing to happen to the confirmation process in the last 50 years, and it would, I think, be better for the Republic. So, and in that, I think it's absolutely fair game to say, well, Judge Kavanaugh, you said one thing, you thought one thing when you're working for Ken Starr about presidential power, and then in the Minnesota Law Review, you said something different, and I think the answer would be yes, because in between, I worked for a president of the United States, and I changed my views about the thing once I actually saw how the presidency operated. And as I say in my op-ed, I actually think that's a good thing that he's changed his mind and admit he's changed his mind. I think really good judges actually are, that's what it means in part to be open-minded. When confronted with new evidence or new experience, one adjusts one's views. In social science terms, one updates or revises one's prior views on the topic. So absolutely fair game to say, why did you change your views? By the way, I think he changed them in the correct direction. And cards on the table, I said all of the things that the later Judge Kavanaugh, the more mature Judge Kavanaugh, said earlier, way back when Bill Clinton was president, and I still believe him today.
Quickly, if you will, then, tell us the difference. What did he go from what to what?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh, when he worked for Ken Starr, I think didn't fully appreciate that all sorts of lawsuits brought against the president could distract a president from keeping his eye on the ball, like getting bin Laden. And once he worked for George W. Bush, he actually mentioned 9/11 in his remarks when introduced by the president. I think he saw that there was the potential for harm to the Republic if presidents were distracted. Now, the proposal that he made was that Congress pass a statute trying to think about sensible presidential immunities from litigation, while keeping wide open the door for possible impeachment for really serious presidential misconduct.
So we're getting some history as we go along here. And as you pointed out, Judge Kavanaugh did work for Ken Starr during the Clinton years. He then worked with the Bush administration. He was in the White House. He married a woman who was the president's secretary, I believe, again has indicated very publicly that he's changed his views. Professor Scotchpole, does that concern you? Did he go in the wrong direction as far as you're concerned?
You know, there's really a simple explanation for why Judge Kavanaugh changed his views. He changed his views because one was a Democratic president and the other a Republican president. And the proposition that a president should be free of all civil and criminal proceedings while they sit in office is un-American. It is quite simply pre-constitutional. It is a view that one has of a monarch. Now, the idea that Donald Trump would somehow be distracted from the work he needs to do as president if he had to sit for a short interview in a civil or criminal proceeding is on the face of it absurd. Judge Kavanaugh should be asked in his hearings to recuse himself. from anything that has to do with whether the man who appointed, who nominated him to the as a justice, should have the law, the full force of the law, and by the way, the full force of unanimous Supreme Court precedents applied to him. I'm sure he'll be asked about that. I don't know his motives, and I really don't think the professor does either. The professor likes the fact that his student is saying what he believes, and I understand that feeling. But I don't really think there's any way to guess why he changed his mind. There is, on the other hand, a pressing need for all the senators, including many Republicans, to ask him whether he really believes that presidents are above normal legal processes, because that's an un-American idea.
Professor Amar, very strong terms here, un-American, monarchical. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've written a bunch of books on the Constitution, and I've written on this specific question, so here's what I can tell you, that the historic view of every Justice Department under both Republicans and Democrats has been, over many, many years, decades, that a president is immune from criminal prosecution, ordinary criminal prosecution, while in office. It was the view of John
Adams. Yeah, but not testifying.
It was, well, let me just first talk about criminal prosecutions. It was the view of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, Joseph Story and his commentaries on the Constitution. It was actually the view of the special prosecutors that we've had in recent memory, at least, that none of them tried to indict a sitting president. That would be Leon Jaworski and Archibald Cox. That was Ken Starr's ultimate judgment that this would be an inappropriate thing to do. So on the ordinary immunity of a president from criminal prosecution, the basic point, which I actually made in testimony before the Senate way back when, is you wouldn't want to let, for example, North Carolina drum up charges against Abe Lincoln in the middle of 1861. You don't want to let the part undo the whole. Any criminal prosecution would travel through a local jury, a local grand jury, and you'd have basically a locality undoing a national election. You don't want that, but you do want a president completely accountable, and the best way to do that is to see the impeachment mechanism as the filtering mechanism for serious criminal charges of criminal accusations against the president, because the Congress, the House of Representatives, is a national grand jury, a grand inquest representing the geographic breadth of the nation, and the trial, in effect, the judge and jury, would be the Senate, again, embodying the nation. So as for criminal prosecution, state or federal, attempts to criminally prosecute a sitting president, that's actually been the traditional legal view. The legal scholars, the great constitutional scholars left and right, Charles Black on the left, Robert Bork on the right.
This is a filibuster about a question that wasn't the question on the table.
Okay, go ahead and respond to it.
Yeah, I mean, lawyers are very, very good at changing the subject. The subject is whether a sitting president should have to sit for testimony in a civil or criminal proceeding.
Oh, well, I could move
and
to that.
That is something that Judge Kavanaugh said should be ruled out.
No,
and that is something
let her
the Supreme Court has ruled on unanimously.
When did they rule on it unanimously, and under what circumstances?
In both the Nixon and the Clinton proceedings.
So, Professor Amar, what about it?
Well, I teach those cases. The Nixon case wasn't about actually a civil lawsuit. The Paula Jones case actually was. And Judge Kavanaugh's position is actually not that that case got it wrong, but that Congress did have the authority, an issue actually that was expressly reserved in the Paula Jones case, Jones versus Clinton, that Congress might very sensibly want to think about structuring a set of sensible immunities and temporary immunities for presidents, even in the civil domain. It wasn't
okay, Professor
Scofield,
your response to that, I don't want to have you accusing us of allowing a filibuster.
It's changing the subject. The question is whether Judge Kavanaugh, should he become Justice Kavanaugh, should rule on those kinds of issues.
Okay.
Oh, well, that's
after
a third issue. If you want to talk about recusal, with all due respect,
after the kinds of statements he has made that suggest that Donald Trump shouldn't have to testify.
So, Professor Amar, very quickly, should he then have to recuse himself?
He'll be asked that question. I think it's a good question for him to be asked. The law of recusal is emphatically
well, should he
the
recuse
opposite.
Himself is the question.
Oh, no. Yes, the law of recusal is actually that this, in general, probably having written something on a topic has never been understood as a proper basis for recusal. If he had been asked to make a promise to President Trump or anyone else, well, then, of course, he would have to recuse himself. And that, I think, is a fair question to ask at confirmation hearings. But having written as a
well, wait a
scholar
minute.
On a topic,
Professor Scopel, should he be given that? Should he be given that leeway? Should he be allowed to say, "I never promised anything to anybody"? Or
well,
is it just because he was appointed?
Yeah,
he was appointed by President Trump.
Of course, that's what he's going to say.
Well,
you know, I mean, this is a fine example of evading all of the current issues that surely motivated Donald Trump, among other things, to appoint this person, to nominate this person.
Okay,
he hopes to be let out of testifying, not criminally indicted. I think we all agree that the Justice Department and previous precedents don't allow the criminal indictment of a sitting president.
Okay, let's go on to another subject, which is certainly paramount in the minds of a lot of people, and that has to do with Roe versus Wade. And Professor Scotchpole, let me start with you. You're not a lawyer, but there are those who say that the constitutional basis for Roe versus Wade is very weak, that even many liberal lawyers agree that that is the case, and yet it would appear that and it appears that it might well be brought back before the U.S. Supreme Court again. What do you expect to happen, and do you think that should be a part of the upcoming hearings between now and Election Day?
Well, it should be a part of them, but you know what? I'm going to speak as a political scientist. Political science is finding and has found now for some years that judges vote straight along the line of the party of the president who appointed them. And in this case, the party that nominated him, the party that has nominated Judge Kavanaugh is the Federalist Society as much as Donald Trump. I think we know that he will either vote to overturn Roe or he will vote for a series of further eviscerations of Roe. My comment on this as a political scientist is that this is not the strongest issue for Democrats to bring forward in the public debate that needs to unfold over the next 2 months. It's not the strongest issue for the simple practical reason that Roe has already been eviscerated for many women, particularly lower and lower middle income women who need access to the option of abortion. It has already been eviscerated by a series of decisions over many decades that have speeded up in recent years at the state and national level. If I had to bet that when he becomes a justice, that Justice Kavanaugh will participate in a further evisceration of Roe rather than an outright declaration of overturning it, at least in the early years. That's because, as a symbol, as a political symbol, it's a symbol of women's freedom to choose. And by the way, choosing can also mean choosing for value-oriented reasons not to have an abortion, even under the most dire circumstances. So choice is choice. It's highly valued in the United States. It's going to persist in the most populous and economically dynamic states, no matter what the Supreme Court does. And I don't think it's the strongest issue to bring forward in the debate about Judge Kavanaugh.
Very quickly, with regard to your earlier statement that justices vote according to the party of the president that nominated them, there are some remarkable exceptions to that, are there not? Earl Warren is one of them. There's a book now called Eisenhower versus Warren.
I said in recent times, okay. And obviously it was different maybe before 15 years ago. And, you know, Justice Kennedy occasionally, although much more occasionally than people are now romanticizing, voted with the liberal group in the Supreme Court. I just don't think we're going to see that in the near future, and we're not seeing it across the federal judiciary very much anymore. We can regret that. I'm just reporting an empirical fact.
Professor Amar, back to you. What about Roe versus Wade as a symbol of women's freedom? If, in fact, it were to be repealed by this court, or reversed by this court, I should say, it would be an all-male decision, apparently. And it's become so important in so many different ways, rather than just the arguments that were made to declare it to be constitutional by the court. Is it somehow more important than the legal and constitutional technicalities?
Well, in the op-ed, I actually call for an open conversation about Roe versus Wade and an effort to try to elicit Judge Kavanaugh's views on whether it was rightly decided or not. I don't want him to make any sort of promise. That would be improper to make any promise of any sort to a president or to a Senate about how he will vote in the future on any issue. And he has to retain, if confirmed, the ability to change his mind. But I think there should be an open conversation in the hearings about Roe and other things. And I share it. Professor Scotchpole's view that health care is extremely important. It's related to this, but it stands alone. And one interesting counterexample to a general tendency of justices to vote, even in recent years, with the party that nominated him, is in the most important case of his life, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, did vote in the main to uphold major portions of the Affordable Care Act. He was the only Republican appointee to do so in a case called Sebelius. Justice Kennedy actually voted with the other Republicans, unfortunately, to my mind, in that case. So good for John Roberts in that. Maybe he was wrong. I think he was right, but he was not partisan about it. He didn't go as far as I would have liked, but still, he's in the main sided with the Democratic appointees on the court. And I think we should ask Judge Kavanaugh in the hearings about that as well.
Dr. Roe versus Wade, what we're hearing from Professor Scotchpole is that it's unlikely that the court will completely reverse the case, but rather that it will chip away at it. Does that sound right to you?
I think she's right that Roe was significantly modified in a case a quarter century later called Casey in 1992, and that Casey enables those who want to chip away at reproductive choice an ability to try to do so and to have the court uphold it without ever having to formally modify or overrule past precedents. The reproductive right, the abortion right, can be hollowed out from within under the existing precedents. I think she's right about that.
Professor Scotchpole, you mentioned that Justice Thomas might be next to leave the court. What reason do you have for saying that?
Well, he's indicated that he would like to step down, and I take Mitch McConnell's a little tweak to his rule that you shouldn't confirm a justice of the Supreme Court just before a presidential election. He said in the second term. I think that's a tell. I believe that if the Democrats lose ground in the Senate significantly in the next election, which is possible, Justice Thomas will step down and they'll put in somebody 20 to 25 years younger. I think that's the name of the game right now. This is very much part of a larger, my research is in part about what is going on with the Republican Party. We are not in the kinds of normal times that gentlemen's bargains or reasonable arguments carry the day. This is a radical party, and they're not going to stop. The most serious consequences of this particular appointment we haven't even touched upon, and that is the further erosion of access to the ballot that has been moving forward with lightning speed and is likely to be redoubled starting as early as this coming year.
You're talking about the gerrymandering cases?
No, I'm not really talking about gerrymandering. I'm talking about the court's increasing willingness to countenance one step after another that makes it harder for low-income minority people to vote, students. And those steps are being taken by state after state. I expect them to speed up. Justice Kennedy completely dropped the ball in the final stages of his career in a shameful way on those cases. And that's not even to get to the whole question of gerrymandering. I think it's a far more fundamental issue whether Americans can easily and readily vote in an equal way. And we're seeing a Republican Party as a whole through a combination of judicial and political means that are determined to hold on to power from a minority position for as long as they possibly can in a changing country.
Your op-ed was called A Liberal's Case for Brett Kavanaugh. You've indicated you're a Democrat. This is an issue that does, in fact, have enormous partisan significance. Do you agree with Professor Scotchpole?
I do. I do share her dissatisfaction, disappointment with Justice Kennedy's fifth key vote in a case called Shelby County versus Holder that undid major portions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, an act that people fought and died for, martyrs to the most fundamental right of all, the right to have all other rights, the right to vote. It's a phrase that appears five times in the Constitution, in the 14th Amendment, Section 2, the 15th Amendment, 19th, 24th, 26th. It is under assault, and the Supreme Court did let us down in Shelby County versus Holder, which, in my view, was one of the two worst cases of the modern era, along with Bush versus Gore. And Justice Kennedy was not great on that. I'm hopeful, and Judge Kavanaugh should be asked about that and more in the confirmation hearings, but it's possible he'll actually be better than Justice Kennedy on that. We don't know. Let's find out.
Very quickly, Professor Scotchpole, what do you think of Professor Amar's idea that the process be opened up, the confirmation process, that senators of both party indicate, okay, we're going to vote for you, but we want to hear more from you, and use that as a way of getting the judge, to actually respond to questions rather than, as so many have in the recent years, simply refuse to answer any questions at all?
It's a sweet, utterly naive idea.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it at that. Go ahead. You had more?
I like sweet, and I'm not holding out. I think that the odds of it being adopted are less than 50-50, but we can try.
Okay.
It would improve the process.
All right. Well, it was wonderful to have you both. So thank you for a very spirited, very interesting conversation. I think one that will give people a real opportunity to know in advance some of the issues that are going to be coming up. Ahil Reed Amar at Yale Law School, Theda Scotchpole at Harvard, where she is with a professor of government and sociology. It's great to have you both, and many thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer has been Joel Stein. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point wherever you get your podcasts. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave a message for other listeners. Let us know what they might hear. Join us again.